My very favorite definition of evil comes from a two-year-old. He was not four-year-old. He was. To Scott Peck's son, and M. Scott Peck wrote a book called People of the Lie that I took the initial prayer from, which was looking at evil. And he wasn't too sure how he ought to define it. And he said, boy, I have to come in and study at the time, and what are you doing, Daddy? And he says, well, I'm trying to figure out how to define evil. And he says, oh, that's easy. That's live, spelled backwards. It works in English and it works for me. what is evil is anti-life, or is the reversal of life. It goes back to that early commandment. I set before you life and death. Choose life. It's those spirit-robbing kinds of things. And we need to do something opposite. And one of the things that Scott Peck concluded was that it was a very dangerous thing to look at evil. And maybe that's why Alfred Nolan wanted to just say, okay, look at suffering. And that's very, very real. But Peck also said, and I was also putting to mind Archbishop Tutu in his book, No Future Without Forgiveness. That is a scary book, because Desmond Tutu can look at the face of evil and report on it from his experiences, not only as a South African, but then as a spiritual leader in South Africa, and then as the head of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That book looks chillingly at the face of extraordinary evil. And almost in self-defense, he will then move into a section that is the most gorgeous song of love about God and God's work in the lives of people and God's invitation. That it's a beautiful thing to read, that it's this very complicated dance, and it makes a great deal of sense when you think of what the real antidote to evil is, and that is love. And so Tutu can look into the face of it, but he has to go back to the love as the inoculation. And certainly you look at him and look at the Dalai Lama, and you look at people who have struggled in the face of tremendous evil, and they somehow have found that path, that anecdote, and they are bright, funny, childlike spirits, and yet their lives have been often right there in the face of evil. I think Nolan is absolutely right that we may not be able to do anything per se about the evil that we encounter in the world and in our own hearts, but we can look to the suffering, we can look to our own pain, we can look to the pain of others, we can stand beside them and be a comfort. And that began sort of, and I'll let you see how weird I get, that led me to feeling that God is always there, even in a situation of immense evil. So what are the signs of God in that place of immense evil? God isn't the evil. God is the antidote. So where is it? And that's, I started kind of looking that way in self-defense, if nothing else. And this is where I can give you an example that sounds weird, but one of the most compelling images that I probably exposed myself too much to was 9/11. I could not tear myself away from those images. And I kept asking myself, God, where are you? And the answer I got was the Eucharist. There were people pouring toward Ground Zero in New York, taking sandwiches. Here is my bread, or here is my body, broken for you. People were fleeing nationwide to blood banks. Here is my blood, given for the forgiveness of all sins. God was in it, not in the evil, but in the caring that was taking place, in the hope, unrealized, as all those emergency medical centers were set up and there was no one to come. I saw it in simpler form with Muhammad Yunus, who was contending with the evil of poverty in Bangladesh. And he could see that the system was all wrong. And what he said was, it's easy to get a Nobel Peace Prize, you just do everything upside down. Well, there's God turning the world upside down, making the world new. But he comes from the tradition of Islam, but that care for the poverty of others. And he has made the world new. We've got an inspired member of Pompo Zimbank, and Maureen, I know you're active with it, that by doing things contrary to the way the world expects things to be done, the jadedness, he was bringing the life of God into the lives of Bangladeshi women, and that has spread around the world to be doing things in a totally opposite way. So I think as much as I felt like no one wanted to sort of step aside from evil, he's absolutely correct that God is found, and we are bringing God into that mix when we are at the side of the suffering and care about what is going on and why suffering is happening. The next chapter, One with Ourselves, that was where I was really threatened. And this is where I have to thank Alice for inviting me to do this. Because I probably most needed this chapter at this particular point. The last 3 years have been really difficult for me, and I guess in the short thing, I can't find a direction. Everything seems to be sort of jumbled up and in a whole bunch of chaos, and I can't find that clear sense of purpose and so forth. I kind of know roughly what I'm supposed to be about, but it's like there's all these roadblocks all over the place, and I can't figure it out. It's been hard. It's been very hard. And in the midst of it, my father passed away, and death crystallizes so much for us. And I haven't begun to process that other than to say that there's a whole bunch of stuff that used to be meaningful that isn't meaningful to me anymore. And the whole family's going through it. You know, we're just all kind of trying to find out what is our life now in the absence of a man we all loved and enjoyed so much. And the fact of walking in life with my father who is dying, it sort of rearranges the priorities in one's life, and I'm in a mess in terms of trying to figure out what those priorities are. So this being one with oneself, all I could think of is, well, I'm not there yet, and I think this is really more accurate. Matthew Fox has this wonderful image of the via negativa, where you're collecting all these sticks and eventually they're all going to be burned. And it's sort of, oh, okay, I'm in that mode at the moment, that there's a lot that I can't sort out. There's a lot I can't figure out. There's like, I I can't do a lot. But I do have this bundle of sticks, and I can embrace them, and I can hug them into acceptance. That somehow that resistance and that sort of internal fighting I'm doing is going to be giving way. Not by any act of will on my part, that doesn't seem to work, but more by the holding of it and that waiting. And maybe that's why Psalm 131 stood out so much to me this time around, that sitting in the lap of a loving God and holding my bunch of sticks and let that be loved into acceptance. The other piece that seems to be emerging and taking kind of a solid form is I probably have spent my entire life looking for stability. I grew up with it and I haven't had it since. And so there's this whole thing, well, if I study and I get, you know, these things, then this will work out. Or if I get the rules of life figured out, then it'll work out. And I keep looking for that stability, and it's been very elusive. Well, again, thanks to a Trinity Church study on saving Jesus, we got to talking about order and how much order the Roman Empire brought in. And I remember back to my studies in architecture, and it was absolutely true. The Roman Empire put a grid on the globe. Prior to the Roman Empire, roads were, you know, nice and curvaceous, and you could get lost easily, and people were very comfortable with it. It was chaos. So then I back up and think, chaos. That sort of, Carl Sagan talks about cosmos being the opposite of chaos, that there's order. That comes out of chaos. We have images of God and creation putting order to the chaos. And where that's taken me is a really odd place. I think God loves chaos. Yeah. And all of a sudden, the chaos of all the ways of looking at the spiritual life, all of the different religions, all of the different truths, all of the, this immense, rich world of spiritual life is chaotic to me. I want to know what the truth is. I want to know exactly. But how do you stay open? And as Nolan points out, accept and love the diversity and uniqueness of all of us, ourselves included, the complexity of our own lives. How do you hold on to that and have any kind of order? And so I'm thinking, I'm not supposed to be looking for stability. I'm not looking for order. That the order comes in the search. The order comes from the image that, of God that Jesus gave us. And where I absolutely started to sing was when Nolan talks about our true selves. And I love the fact that he points out that these things kind of happen without our intent necessarily. It goes back to that, Lord, when did I see you hungry? You know, there's a certain level of unconsciousness that is holy. He says, when you find yourself moved by compassion for those who are in need, your true self is manifesting itself. When you recognize a moment of honesty and sincerity as you long to know the truth about yourself or about anything else in life, that's the real you. Being overwhelmed by gratitude for all the gifts and graces in your life is something that wells up from your very being. At those moments when you unexpectedly act with courage and uncharacteristic bravery, that also was an impulse that comes from something very deep in you. If you've ever experienced the quiet joy of sidelining your ego by doing something for others without any reward, without being thanked, and without anyone even knowing about it, then you're in touch with your true self. And when you are swept away by wonder and awe, you are allowing your true self to take over. This is where I sing. God works in us, but God does so through our true selves. The oneness of the small particular self with the greater universal self. This is what makes you and me infinite. How could we? I can't improve upon that wonderful. That's a doxology. So I'm trying to find a home in the chaos. And I know that home is God. And I'm trying to find that home in the middle of lots of deaths. Not just the physical death of my father, but deaths of dreams and deaths of certainties and deaths of fancy plans and deaths of my own youth. I'm there right now, just trying to hold that. But I think Nolan gives us that sweet assurance that all of it is somehow about coming around to our true self. And that is what we can trust, and that is what God will do in the work of our lives. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You had us start out, Christine, by with the question, "Who are you?" Mm-hmm. Was that what you were aiming at? You kind of wrapped it up there at the end with, what kinds of things do you think should come out in a question like "Who are you"? Should it be a spiritual biography, or should it be?
One of the beauties when you can do that for a longer period of time, and Martha, remind me, it seemed to me that we were doing that for over a half an hour.
Awfully long.
Yeah. But one of the things that begins to happen, and I'll pull a phrase from mediation and conflict resolution, you don't want to move forward in a conflict until it's fully textured. And that's sort of what began to happen in that you start off with, who are you? Well, I'm a mother, I have two kids. You know, you sort of do the biographical stuff. And I was with a total stranger who was very, very vulnerable, and he immediately went into his pain. And I was so frightened. I don't know how he got it. But what happened, I think, to a lot of us is we suddenly stopped with the biography and got to those places of, well, who am I? I'm this really confused person who I just don't know which way to look. God is merciful. God loves you. I'm this really angry person. This life of mine has just made my life miserable, and I just don't know what to do with this anger. God is merciful. God loves you. There got to be this incredible depth of just our beingness that got textured, and always in the mercy of God and the love of God, incarnated in the other person. And so if you stay with it for a while, it really takes you deep. Well, boy, what a wonderful dialogue between a husband and wife. Or any relationship. It was very healing, very healing. Do you have a question?
I don't have a question. I just want to share with everybody. When we were at La Casa and started an organic garden, Chris was also working there. And the day that we actually kind of broke the soil open, she came and it poured rain. And I will never, and we consider this a real baptism. I will never forget Chris standing there with lovely shoes on that were about this deep in water. And I thought, what compassion and love you have that you would do that.
I don't remember.
I still envision you doing that every time I see rain. I think of Chris standing in the rain and helping us to actually baptize on you.
I do so many things like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot about that.
it struck me when you said that God is in the chaos. The other day, I just had that instance thought myself. And, you know, I've always been taught scripture as order out of chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, it's these cycles of order out of chaos. And I didn't give it much reflection or anything. And I don't even remember how it came to be, but I just remember thinking, maybe it's the chaos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think there's real gifts in there. I mean, that's part of that radical freedom. You know?
Well, I think we think of it as chaos because we want it to be how we want it to be. You know, God's mind is not like ours. I mean, I hear again, you know, every time you're with a group of women or parents that have children getting married or with young kids, you know, you hear this, oh, they're not Catholic, they're marrying, you know, there's all this anxiety, they're not going to church, they're not doing what we brought them up to do, they're anxious, and I said, you know, God is giving us a message to expand, to accept other races, to accept other religions, to open our hearts and to change, you know, from our narrow views. And so, to me, the chaos is caused by us wanting to have it the way we think it should be.
Oh, that's very good insight.
Many times, you know.
That tricky ego and super ego again.
Yeah, and God doesn't really see the chaos and the diversity. Mm-hmm. And we see it because we're uncomfortable and we don't know what will happen and we fear the worst and, you know.
So, oh, yeah.
You know.
That's very true. Very good.
It reminds me, years ago, one method of the trained visually impaired people with the cane was to take them out to a real busy, noisy street and blindfold them, make sure they didn't get any hint of direction, and put the cane in their hands and go find the curtain. If you could do it, you had it made. Mm-hmm. And so often in chaos that God says, here, I give you the cane, go find the way.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a dangerous thing to do. They don't do it anymore. A lot of people, they say, I can't do it. I mean, they were washed out. Mm-hmm. But I think God gives us that extra cane.
Yeah.
And you're not alone, but you've got to trust.
Well, that's
you know, like you said, keep on walking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor. Right.
Well, we think of biodiversity as a good thing, and we think of heirloom tomatoes as a good thing with all their different varieties. Now, but when it comes to our own very own churches, we don't want them breaking up. You shared with us your grief about the... So what is it about... could you imagine the fractioning of the Episcopal Communion as... in some way, a blessing?
No.
Not an asset. What's the story?
I guess what concerns me most is it's not just in the Episcopal Church, it's whenever our faiths, the language becomes a language of hatred. For me, that's what hurts the most. One person or one group of people's understanding becomes the norm. Mm-hmm. And anything that is off of that norm is to be despised, hated, judged, and so forth. That kind of goes back to that question of who do you say I am? The people who define God as this judge who's going to put people into hell, they are living a very different image of God than what appears to be Jesus' teaching of a humble and loving servant God. You know, I'm very comfortable with a loving, and I'm very comfortable with the Jesus who was with the prostitutes and the lepers and the rich men and all of those, the whole breadth of humanity. So it's that piece that just deeply disturbs me. And I know how easy it is to fall into the self-righteousness. And people are good. As I look through, you know, all kinds of religions, I love to read broadly. It's just, life isn't served. it lives spelled backwards. Mm-hmm. And yet the option appears to be to step into this chaos. That's challenging too. Where's your moral compass? How do you tell what is right or wrong? And then I go back to the ground of Jesus' spirituality and to the God that Jesus taught us so much about. You know, there is the moral compass. And it didn't say a whole bunch that was judgmental in that sense. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that in the very beginning with Peter and Paul, you know, we took that road of inclusiveness rather than staying with the Jewish boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And it somehow, it seems to me that it helps, you know, maybe we need to move beyond thinking of one is right and one is wrong, because there were still some people who stayed with the Jewish culture, felt more comfortable, mm-hmm. and does that mean that they had to hate the people who went off with Paul and had this more inclusive vision of who Christians could be?
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe, you know, that's the thing, even in the Catholic Church, is, well, if you don't believe all these things, then you have to leave, deform what's there mm-hmm. to be what you think would be, or do you take a little group and go off elsewhere, and it's okay mm-hmm. to go off elsewhere. So I think that's where it becomes a problem, is when who is the essence of this that is, and what can it say to where others need to go mm-hmm. to be authentic?
Mm-hmm. Last week, Father Virgil said something really significant. He said, when asked about the Nicene Creed, he said, what we need is a creed of spirituality, mm-hmm. not a creed of dogma. Mm-hmm. Because when you become dogmatic, you're trying to control things. That's mm-hmm. the absence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I thought that was
mm-hmm.
revolutionary, really. Mm-hmm. I think it's the truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to that, I've been annoyed for the last number of years, realizing that it's virtually only in English that the creed is said in the first person plural, and it just seems so arrogant and you know that we are speaking for what other people believe in Latin, in the original Latin, in the Spanish, and the Italian. It's always I believe, and people are speaking to their own belief, but only in English. Now, why is that? What does that say about our mm-hmm. insistence that we've got the right picture?
Please correct me, because I'm not a biblical scholar, but it seems to me that the first measure of the Christian community was to see how they love one another. That was the centurion's reaction at the crucifixion. You know, Jesus was loving the people around him, the thieves, his mother, his disciples that stayed. And that was a conversion experience for that centurion. He must be God. So it seems that the signature is that love and not the doctrine that then becomes a basis for judging insiders, outsiders, in-groups, out-groups, all of those things. And that's the scariest piece for us as human beings. We love so poorly that we get our defenses by not working.
I think it's interesting that organized religion, at least in Christianity and Islam, have always been very opposed to the mystics.
Mm-hmm.
Because mysticism and this kind of thing that Nolan is talking about, this connection with God, is very threatening to organizational structures, because mm-hmm. it does have this freedom as mm-hmm. this chaos. And so you see the Sufis in Islam being persecuted, mm-hmm. you see endless numbers of folks in Christianity being persecuted. So the tension, I think that's a piece of the tension between order and call it chaos or openness, is mm-hmm. it's certainly in our institutions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that the problem with that is of course because it's change. And change is the key to life.
and we just hate it. You know, that's the problem, really, basically. Mm-hmm. Is change is the only
power.
Thing.
It is power.
Yeah.
It is power.
Threatens the power of those in power.
Yeah. And it's money. You know, if we lose corporations, do we lose money? Do we lose income?
Oh, right.
How are we going to survive? How can
you
support the
institution?
Yeah, how can you sort of
turn that world upside down like Johnny said? I don't have the answers, and I don't necessarily have the lifestyle to make it, but I know it's there.
Did I hear you correctly to say that you did not remember that episode when you were standing in
there? No, I didn't.
That's the wonderful thing. I think it was a real message. There are countless times when we, without knowing it, and we're open to the Spirit, are angels to the people around us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was a great example of your being God incarnate to this lady, and you didn't know it.
And there's, I didn't include this in my talk, but I wanted to, about the time I was asked to do this was when the book that was Mother Teresa's letters to her spiritual advisor in print, and I didn't pick it up and I didn't read it, so I didn't include it. But in the description of it, I thought, here is something really important, because she did not feel connected to God. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a single person in this room would say, what? Of course she was connected. But it's that lack of ego awareness, that really open vessel quality that you know, we probably have all of us touched in one way or another, and it might come back to us. And my version of heaven is that's what we finally get to see. But you know, there is that true self quality that is God working through us, and I think it just is a. I suspect it's just a moment of feeling fully alive, you know, and we aren't analytical about it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about that with Mother Teresa, and what you were talking about before about the 27 friends that you could think of that wasn't God, you know, as angels. John the Baptist, and this to me is one of the big differences between John the Baptist and Jesus, is that in why Jesus refers to him as the greatest born of woman but the least in the kingdom, because John the Baptist was able to point over there. And I think in a way Mother Teresa could see the Christ over there, could see the Christ in the poor. But Jesus knew himself to be God, to be actually within him. The least in the kingdom has this understanding of union. So the God you were looking for in depth, that was the God with you.
Mm-hmm.
But to say that's all there is to God, you know, there's always a larger that you're never going to sum it up and put it in a box. But it's that union. We're not trained towards it, and it's something you experience, and it's what made Jesus so scandalous, is that he was equating himself with God. Well, Jesus is the template for, you know, at some point, in order really to be in the kingdom, we have to, in the quiet somewhere, experience ourselves in that union.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're in that union, it's not just God and me, it's universal.
It's universal.
Everything. And so you can't, you're not putting, I'm God, not right. Unless you're saying that everything's included in that. But that's the point of freedom that I think Albert Nolan's pointing to in this text, is the freedom of knowing ourselves in union with God. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody knows this answer, but with Mother Teresa, I always thought, you know, she was given this mission and God visited her and told her what to do. Now, I've never had that, and I don't know if any of you have, but once you have that, would you yearn for that forever, to really have that, you know, total knowledge and experience, like she said, of knowing what your mission was by God? So I always feel, I mean, I don't know if anybody's written about this or
you know, but I always felt like that's why she feels like, you know, she's separated from God, having once had that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. You know, you would always, I think desire that.
Real.
She's not going to get that till the other side, probably. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a constant thing where, you know.
And I think, isn't that true for all of us?
Yeah. Right?
I mean, her favorite meditation was on Christ's words, "I thirst." And I think that, my guess is that's her. And then I heard about the book, and I do want to read it. That was her experience. She's thirsty. I think when you have that that moment, and they come, you know, not in your control, that it leaves you with a yearning, and that is a profound gift. And it's frustrating because then the push button fulfillment necessarily, or clarity, or you know, any number of things that we might want to put as a list. But that yearning is what keeps you coming for 30 years now. You know, you just keep trying to keep yourself open and yearning. You never know when God's going to break through. Usually the moment of greatest need, for sure. That I trust.
I think we better make that
for us. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. For somebody who approached these chapters with trepidation, I think you did a marvelous job at putting experience that touched each one of us at some place in our lives onto what is a great mystery, and then putting it all in the context of God is merciful and God loves us. There isn't anything greater to say, so thank you very much for that wonderful presentation. Okay, we're going to close with the last two verses, 5 and 6 of the Canticle of the Sun. And anybody that can, if they could stay afterwards and help, because the Liturgy Committee is going to have a meeting right afterwards, so the faster we can get the hall back in order, the better it will be for us. So, thanks. Okay.
And I just want to say, Christine felt like we were singing this song at a snail's pace, so let's pick it up. Every measure will get one.